Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Teacher, lawyer, editor, prophet, pirate, state legislator, historian, and king of earth and heaven. Believe it or not, these titles all belong to one man, James Strang. In 1843, young lawyer and avowed atheist Strang fled rural New York and reappeared in what is now Burlington, Wisconsin. While in the Midwest, he converted to a new religious movement called Mormonism. Following the murder of church founder Joseph Smith, Strang claimed that the prophet named him successor. During antebellum America, Strang managed to convince his followers to move to Beaver Island in northernmost Lake Michigan to create a pirate colony where polygamy, theft, corruption, and many frauds were practiced. The story of how an atheist managed to become a self-proclaimed divine king until his assassination in 1856 is fascinating, and Miles Harvey wrote all about it. Harvey's new book on James Strang is called The King of Confidence. He joins me now to share more about this infamous con man.
Well, it's one of the great reinvention stories of the 19th century, which was absolutely full of such stories. So Strang grew up a farm boy in Western New York. It was a hugely religious place at that time. It was called the Burned Over District because there were so many religious and political and cultural fires burning there. But he was an atheist, but his journals are available from his time he was about 17 or 18 to a time he was in his early 20s. And he in code writes that he's a secret atheist, but he also writes about how when he talks about religion, people really get excited. Well, in any case, he was a failure in everything he did there, and he got out of town under suspicious circumstances, kind of flew by night, and showed up eventually in Burlington, visited Nauvoo, which was then the center of Mormon religion and culture, a town on the Mississippi in Illinois, and converted to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And in 1844, Joseph Smith, the founder of that church, was murdered by a mob. And shortly thereafter, Strang claimed that Smith had handed over the entire church to him.
Yeah, through this letter, you know, that many people have scrutinized over, and he also produced these bronze plates to convince people that here's another story that was just for me that only I can translate. And you mentioned, you know, people get fired up when they heard him talk about religion and such. What was it about this period in time? We're talking mid-1800s, 1840s onwards, about antebellum America that made it ripe for Strang to capture people and ascend into a religion he, you know, in all accounts was very new to.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain periods in history when the truth becomes malleable. And in the case of antebellum America, which was, of course, the years before the Civil War, there was just incredible societal tremors, a communications revolution, a depression that was the worst thing America had ever encountered, incredible changes in technology, you know, the camera, the telegraph, the railways. America is just suddenly a different place. There's great demographic dislocation. Suddenly it's a nation of strangers. And at times like this, someone like Strang, who makes his own truth and has great confidence in preaching his truth to other people, tend to thrive. There's a reason this period gave birth to the word confidence man. We know exactly when that word started in 1849. And we know exactly how quickly it spread throughout the culture because there were so many of these people. It's also the period where P.T. Barnum, the great hoaxer, public hoaxer, was prominent and, in fact, a superstar. And so I think the fact that Strang was a man who understood what was going on around him and understood how it might fit his personal needs led to his ascension in the minds of hundreds of people to King of Earth and Heaven.
Before we get to his colony in Wisconsin, I want to talk about what Strang you know, how he differed from other Mormons. So what did Strang preach and practice in Mormonism that was different from the larger sect that was currently being formed and led by Brigham Young? This is right before they're heading out to Utah, basically.
So Strang had one big difference with Young at the beginning, which was that he was opposed to polygamy. And he said, I'll never change on this. This is my diehard principle. It's sort of like Lindsey Graham's diehard principle about Supreme Court nominations. It quickly changed once he picked up a following. Many people came to him because he opposed polygamy, but he ended up dying with five wives, four of them pregnant at the time of his death in 1856. But I think more than anything else, he offered people a sense that he was a prophet of God. You know, Young initially sort of billed himself as an efficient technocrat who could take over the church for Young. And this might have been a mistake on Brigham Young's part. The other thing that Strang had really going for him was location. When the Mormons were kicked out of Nauvoo by mobs with the cooperation of the government and forced to move west, they were going into completely unknown territory. And Strang was just a few hundred miles away in a nice prairie town in Wisconsin. And he said to a lot of Mormons who are really worried about their personal safety and that of their family, why don't you just move up here?
The colony you're talking about is called Voree, and this is right in Burlington today, what is known as Burlington. So what made the Burlington area ideal to settle and make Voree, and what did it turn to that made Strang need to relocate to Beaver Island in Lake Michigan?
Well, I mean, Voree, Burlington is a beautiful, beautiful place. And it's right, the listeners who know Southern Wisconsin know that it's right where the White and Fox River come together. I mean, I suppose it was a okay place for a colony anyway, but the advantage to Strang was that he was living there. He had moved there, and some people who knew him at the time think his whole attempt at becoming a prophet of God was an attempt to just pull off a real estate scam in Voree, where he and his friends owed a lot of property. So that was one thing. I think actually Burlington proved to be a very bad place for him in certain ways, because it was porous, right? His followers could leave, and many of them did. They got out there. They were really impoverished there. And the better you got to know Strang sometimes, the more he came off as less than a prophet. But his opponents stayed. He lured some real bigwigs from the Mormon church to come to Burlington. And some of them quickly turned against him and announced that he was a fraud. And so I think he just needed someplace where he could have more control. And so eventually he and some of the sort of con men around him eyed Beaver Island, which is in the northernmost reaches of Lake Michigan.
So how did you find accounts of what life was like on Beaver Island? You know, there's a lot of circumstances or events throughout this book that are speculative by nature, but also the nature of the story is so unique that I feel like as a reader, I couldn't completely dismiss or discount anything. So how were you able to find bits and pieces?
Well, there's a lot of documentary evidence. Yale University has a huge collection. Strang ran a newspaper in which he spoke, through which he spoke all the time. He was a little bit like President Trump with Twitter. He was anxious to communicate his views, anxious to pick fights with other people. So some of the critical newspaper stories about Strang, we know about because he republished them in full in his own newspapers. But there were also really good accounts by people who lived there, including about sort of domestic life there. And finally, I lucked out in that there's been a revolution in the past, say, 10 years of digitizing 19th century newspapers. And so I was really able to get some information that other researchers just couldn't have had access to a few years ago. And so I think I was really able in the King of Confidence to expand our knowledge of Strang, both his good works and his bad.
So you mentioned he kept up a newspaper, wrote articles, and his diary was only up until his early 20s. So do you see a difference in the words you read from his diary versus what he was controlling and putting out to his people in the newspaper? You know, did you ever get a true sense of who he was?
Well, I mean, So the 19th century and the antebellum period in particular was this, you know, this great age of the self-made man, right? We think about all sorts of self-made men from this period, including Lincoln, who Strang had many things in common with. And so Strang was just a brilliant self-inventor. And so what you see in his diaries is a guy who says, I want to be king. He says at one point in the diaries, you know, if only I had the chance, I would marry Princess Victoria, later Queen Victoria of England, and I would be a great king. And so in some ways, these crazy ideas of a farm boy in Western New York were really self-actualized. I mean, he became a lawyer. He became, you know, a legislator in the Michigan State Legislature, in the Michigan House. He did an amazing amount of stuff, and it's all stuff he dreamed about as a young man. So in some ways, there's a real consistency between the crazy notions he has in his diary and the crazy realities he brought about in his life.
There's a quote in the book that says, someone observing Strang, quote, he does not seem to be conscious that all his professions of piety and religion are utterly negatived by his conduct.
Yeah. And actually, if I could just correct you a little bit, that quote's about P.T. Barnum in a chapter where I'm writing about Strang and his attempts to formalize himself to a broad public in the way Barnum did with his autobiography. Yeah, but I thought I used that quote because I thought it applied to Strang too. I think that he probably believed that what he was doing was in some way righteous just because he was doing it. So, you know, people ask me all the time, do you think he actually thought of himself as a prophet for God, a prophet of God? And I think it's a really hard question.
The Mormons on Beaver Island are really characterized as pirates that terrorize other people on the island, people within boating reach, you know, going to Wisconsin and Michigan to just steal supplies, thinking that we can steal from people who aren't Mormons because it's our rights. And, you know, it really dampers the idea of they're living in some sort of utopia. And do you think these ideas of utopias, especially in antebellum period, can be attributed more towards a want or need to escape versus a true desire for man to live in a better society?
Well, I think the utopian impulse, which was widespread at this time in the United States, has really complex roots. I mean, I think in some ways it's just a reaction to the brutal realities of capitalism at the time. But I also think that people really hoped and dreamed of something better. I mean, Strang's followers thought that they were bringing about the second coming of Christ on Beaver Island in Lake Michigan. Now that may sound absurd to us now, but it was not absurd to them then. And I think that explains among the true believers on his colony why they might engage in theft. In other words, you know, I don't have time to worry about your Wisconsin state laws right now. I got to bring about the second coming of Christ. And so we need these materials. We need this food. We need these supplies. We're just going to take them. It was something that was sometimes justified in Mormon culture at that time, and especially on Strang's colony, as what's called consecration. So there was that. But he also surrounded himself with some very cynical con men types. And even among them, there was a certain kind of righteousness and weirdness that was just wonderful. One of them was a guy named George J. Adams, who went around the country performing Shakespeare on one night and preaching for Strang on the other. And he was kind of a famous guy at this period, just full of bombast, outrageous drunk, a man with supposedly terrible body odor, but also someone who could really bring in the followers, who convinced a lot of people to join Strang's sect. And before that had toured England and brought many, many recruits to the American wilderness at Nauvoo. So yeah, I think the utopian impulse is just so complex at this time. And many good things came out of it and many bad things came out of it.
Strang, you know, our listeners so far will hear that he self-actualized a lot of the things he set out to do, but he also was a target of the federal government. You know, he had the attention of the president. faced federal trial. Lots of things were, you know, tried to bring him down, and ultimately he was assassinated by a couple of previous followers. And I'm wondering, do modern-day Mormons have an official stance on James Strang and this unique sect of Mormonism?
Yeah, I think they had the same stance. I mean, I'm certainly not an expert on Mormon theology or Mormon culture, and I would never presume to pass myself off as anything but someone who's interested and who knows a little bit about this offshoot story. But, you know, Strang was kicked out of the church at the time. So it wasn't like he was accepted by the Brighamite Mormons. On the other hand, he presented a real challenge to Brigham Young. I mean, there was a period in 1853, which was well into Strang's kingdom and well into, you know, the history of Salt Lake City, where even one of Young's top officials took seriously the possibility that Strang might be appointed governor of Utah, which would have been a real mess for Brigham Young. So Strang had sort of extraordinary power over people who should have had power over him. You mentioned just quickly that a U.S. president went after him. It's very true. We laugh about Strang now sometimes, but Millard Fillmore took his threat of an independent kingdom on U.S. soil seriously enough that he invaded the island with the Navy's first iron-hulled warship and dragged Strang back to trial in Detroit. Strang won. He was acquitted. His people were acquitted. And when Millard Fillmore, the U.S. president, left office in 1853, kind of in disrepute, Strang was still king.
What stuck with you the most after, you know, all this time of working on this book and all the primary research combing through this? You know, was there maybe a particular event or little tidbit you read, or even just a realization of this man you came to know?
Well, I think, you know, as a writer, whether you're a fiction writer or a nonfiction writer, you yearn for three-dimensional people to write about. And Strang was that. You know, I think with The King of Confidence, I've sort of pushed our understanding of him as a criminal and the leader of a criminal enterprise. You know, other writers have said there's not absolute proof he did any of this, despite multiple and widespread newspaper stories about it. But I've sort of put him on the scene of a crime and sort of pinned down other aspects of his followers going to jail in a way that probably hadn't been done before. But I also think I've kind of expanded like a fascinating side of him, which is his belief in the abolition movement. I think it's the one true thing that Strang believed in. And it's the one thing that he pursued that was not in his self-interest. So when he was in the Michigan House, he voted against his own party, the Democrats, for legislation, for instance, that would undercut the Fugitive Slave Act, which was a hugely controversial piece of legislation which allowed Southern slave hunters to come into the North after slaves. And I think I've sort of pinned down through some research why Strang believed in abolitionism and why this was the one true thing he embraced. That was what sticks with me, is just Strang as a fascinating figure, full of good and evil and over serious self-belief, but also a sense of humor sometimes. I just found him amazing to think about for 5 years, and I'll miss him.
Well, yeah, fascinating man, certainly made for a fascinating book and read. So, Miles Harvey, thanks so much for talking to me about it today.
Oh, thank you, Audrey. I really appreciate it.
Miles Harvey is the author of The King of Confidence, a tale of utopian dreamers, frontier schemers, true believers, false prophets, and the murder of an American monarch. He'll talk more about it in a virtual event this evening for the Wisconsin Book Festival.